Because it is the poor cousin between two rather spectacular other centuries. You know, people think of the Renaissance, the Reformation of the 16th century, of course, which was hugely impactful on history, and then the Enlightenment of the 18th century, which we are the inheritors of. And so the 17th century, sandwiched between them, does get cast into the shade just a little bit. And yet when you dig into it, you find that it is the most extraordinary period of time, because it is the moment at which the human mind really shifted on its hinges, began to see the universe in a completely different way. I mean, one reason why it's been overlooked as a century is that so many important things happened in it that each one of them has been, as it were, separated out. So people looked at the 30 Years' War, people looked at the Civil War in England, people looked at the Scientific Revolution of the 17th century, people looked at the origins of modern philosophy in the 17th century, and so they looked at each one by itself and didn't really take notice of the fact that it was part of one great story, because all these different aspects of it fed into one another and made one another possible. And so when you take them in the aggregate, you suddenly see that this is a very, very extraordinary period of time. Well, the most dramatic way to illustrate it is to point out that at the very beginning of the 17th century, people were still thinking that this planet of ours was at the center of the universe and that we human beings were at the pinnacle of creation. And by the end of the century, that view had been completely and utterly exploded. So if you imagine a human self-perception by the end of the century was 180 degrees different from how it had been just 100 years before. So our view of ourselves, our view of the moral universe that we occupy, our view of politics, for example, changed dramatically. Our view of what is possible for human beings to do with their minds. After all, right until the end of the previous century, people had been under the control of an orthodoxy over thought. You had to believe a certain thing. If you didn't, if you went against the prevailing view of things, you could jolly well end up at the stake. But by the end of the 17th century, that had all gone, and people were free to inquire. And that indeed is why the Enlightenment of the 18th century happened, because people were free to think.
Now, of course, you could devote a large amount of time to the 30 Years' War. Now, what was it about the 30 Years' War that actually enabled these things to happen?
Well, I should say that the 30 Years' War has been exhaustively examined, actually, which is one reason why the rest of the century gets overlooked, because it was by far the most destructive war that Europe had ever seen to that point in its history. It was the most appalling war. One out of every three German-speaking peoples, and they were the largest and most vigorous peoples of Central Europe, died either directly or indirectly because of the war. It was devastating. Great armies sweeping backwards and forwards across the landscape of Europe, trampling the agriculture, stealing the cows and horses, raping the women. I mean, it was just an appalling time. And one of the most appalling things that happened in it was the sack of Magdeburg, a beautiful city, a flourishing, rich city in one of the German lands, which in 1631 was attacked by the forces of the Holy Roman Empire. It was the population was massacred, every single man, woman, and child, and the city was burnt to the ground. This is just one illustration of the impact of what was a very vicious and devastating war. And the result of it, of course, the war ranged from 1618 until 1648, that is right in the middle of the 17th century, was the fragmentation of Europe into the nation states. And we've seen what that has brought about, several more centuries of war between the nation states, not cured until the European Union came into existence. In the 16th and 17th century, what you witness was a tremendous struggle by the mind of Europe to break free from the control, the imposition of orthodoxy by, until then, a powerful religion. So think of the parallel today. Think of Muslim-majority countries where to be an apostate, to disagree with the faith, is to risk death, just as it had been in Christendom up to that point. And we may be witnessing now when we see, you know, people do get very, very anxious, quite rightly, about acts of terrorism in the United States and the UK and Paris and Brussels and so on. Those are the splashovers, the sort of byblows of what in the Middle East is the most awful, tragic, internecine a battle between different aspects of Islam, between the Sunnis and the Shias. You know, what's happening in Syria and Iraq is really a proxy war between Saudi Arabia and Iran. But it's also a war for the soul of Islam. And there are many people, many Muslims themselves, especially some of the reformist scholars and forward thinkers who were eager for a reformation, such as happened in Christian times, liberating thought, liberating the possibility of criticism and self-analysis, and is the faith really fit for purpose in our modern world? That kind of question is a very challenging question for anybody who has a deep commitment to their religion, but that is a parallel, because in the 16th and 17th century, that's exactly what happened.
At the risk of bringing another philosopher to the table, do you think that this is really just a reflection of what Toffler warned us about in Future Shock?
Well, it may be in the more general sense that we already have the future with us and we don't realise it. There are many respects in which what the future is going to be like, what the changes now happening are going to produce, are things that we barely recognise. I mean, let me give you an example. It's less than two decades since we've all become completely equipped with these wonderful electronic means of communication, iPhones and the internet and Facebook and so on, social media. We embrace them with great enthusiasm because of their enormous utility and facility. But they've stripped us of our privacy. They've laid us bare to the view of any public or private agency that wants to know anything about us. Most of that is innocuous. Some of it isn't. I'll give you one example of the way in which it isn't innocuous. We all know that Google, for example, profiles us on the basis of the sites that we land on so that it can target advertising to us. But it also, on the basis of its profile of us, when we ask for information on Google, gives us the information it thinks we would like to have on the basis of what it thinks we are like as people, as individuals. Now, that is insidious when you think about it, because when you're looking for information, you just want information. You want the facts. You don't want the facts that somebody else thinks you would like to hear. And that, I mean, that's just one little straw in a gale of straw blowing around us brought by these changes. So what their impact will be is very difficult to evaluate, but we are certainly already living with the future and we need to be as conscious as we can about it, partly by looking back into the past to learn its lessons.